I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast that talks about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Katie. She manages both OCD and anorexia. Let's talk about it.
It is literally neither here nor there.
But you know what is here and there is our guest tonight, Katie. Hi.
Hi.
How'd you like that for a transition?
That was
pretty good, eh?
I thought it was mediocre.
Here, pull that mic right up close to your face.
Like, it wasn't much of a segue because you started recording.
Yeah, there you go.
You started the recording right in the middle of the segue, so it wasn't really, for the listeners, it wasn't segueing from anything.
Sometimes we just cut into that, though, and
it
people
was
just don't
just
know.
The beginning.
So here, I want to throw this out there right away. I'm excited for this episode for two reasons. Number one, the last time we covered one of the things that we're going to talk about tonight, it was one of my, like, it was an episode that blew my mind. OCD. We're going to be talking about OCD. Spoiler alert. But we're also going to be talking about, I think, eating disorders as well,
yeah.
Which is also a topic that every fucking time we get into on the show blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Also, the feedback that we get from those episodes is always a little bit mind blowing. Have you listened to, do you know what Sick Boy Podcast is?
Yeah, I've heard about it vaguely, just
okay,
randomly.
Okay, good. I'm
but
glad
no,
we found
those disorders are actually, from what I've read, they're cousin disorders.
Yeah.
So they're very similar. And I read somewhere that in the next DSM, they're thinking about putting anorexia eating disorders under OCD.
Oh, really?
Oh, interesting.
Anorexia, the lack of eating and exercise are compulsions that are very similar to OCD compulsions.
Yeah.
With the intrusive thought of I'm fat or I'm gaining weight, therefore I have to do this thing. And typically people with eating disorders have special numbers. One of my best friends also has an eating disorder. So she has actually educated me on when I developed one and was like, what the fuck's going on? And
you
like,
just blew my mind
I was thinking
we've been recording
thing.
For 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit. That makes so much sense.
Yeah,
the relationship between the two things.
My psychiatrist was just like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Like, oh, you yeah. have both together. It's like that sucks."
It's like one of those things where you're like, "Oh, I've never thought of it that way," but as soon as you explain it like that, yeah. it makes
yeah.
total sense.
Yeah. Well, you guys had someone on, Kenzie, and yeah. I think she talked about like she has anorexia, and she talked about someone for OCD.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it's just very common.
Put a pause on that for 1 second. Okay, we're back. Had to fix a little audio technical issue. But the people listening to this don't even know that we took a three-minute break
there. The magic of editing.
So Katie, what came first, the chicken or the egg? The OCD or
general,
the...
In philosophically?
Yeah. Yes, in general. What came first, the OCD or the
OCD.
Eating disorder?
Yeah, the OCD started first. I've had it since I was a child, right? So like 10 years old. It made me very physically ill. So I had what I believe is called somatic disorder, where your brain is so stressed out that it could cause physical pain in your body.
Whoa.
So what happened
That's
was that
fucking crazy.
Growing up, I was always very ill. I always got fevers. I had a lot of stomach pain. I was brought to the hospital all the time, and my parents were just kind of like, oh, you know, she probably has an allergy. She probably is just sick.
Wait, so you were basically willing yourself to, like, mentally spurring on physical illness within your body?
Basically, like, I think it was just the stress associated with my intrusive thoughts and my compulsions. Like, I was just so stressed as a kid because I was like, I'm not normal.
So just to kind of like rewind a little bit, because we recently in Vancouver, recently with like within the last 12 months or so, spoke with a woman named Megan who had OCD. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who may have missed that episode, because we actually went through a lot of these things like intrusive thoughts and like how OCD can like manifest physically. What are intrusive thoughts?
Intrusive thoughts are unwanted thoughts. So they come into your brain and they make you uncomfortable. They make you anxious. And they make you so anxious that you feel the need to have a compulsion, something that's going to make them less anxiety provoking. So I had thoughts that my parents were going to die and it was going to be my fault. So basically I would think, you know, I need to do all these different things. I needed to rearrange my room all the time. I needed to wash my hands. I needed to do all these different things in order to avoid my parents dying. And so that was like really stressful as a 10-year-old.
And are you, I mean, obviously as a 10-year-old, I'm assuming you can't like rationalize or go, these are, mm-hmm. I don't need to do these or these don't make, there's no relationship between washing my hands and my parents dying. Like it's very, obviously very, well, tough, yeah, very it's hard just, for you to.
Could you? Could, but like,
I
was
don't
there
think a, so,
no,
because,
not at all.
I mean, if you think about it back then, like even watching movies and stuff, like it's called magical thinking. So like these associations you have, assuming like these bad things are going to happen to you just because.
Mm-hmm. Magical just, thinking sounds so fun.
Yeah, it does, and it wasn't. It was terrible.
So how often does it happen though? Because like I think of when I was like maybe 10 years old, you know that little rhyme, if you step on a crack, you break your mother's back.
Yeah.
So like I would walk down the street and that rhyme would come into my head sometimes and I'm like, oh shit, I can't step on cracks or I'm going to break my mom's back.
Right.
But like I would do that for 5 minutes and then just forget about it.
Yeah.
And
it's like a fun game.
It wasn't it didn't cause disorder in my life. Yeah.
But then Katie steps on the crack and she's like, fuck, and goes home and washes her hands until they bleed and then goes back out.
So, but how often was that happening? Like the rearranging of your room
just
and washing your hands?
Every day, morning to night. So I had morning rituals. I had during the day rituals. I had night rituals. It took me like 45 minutes or to an hour to get to bed because of how many things I had to do before going to bed.
At 10.
Yeah. So, and growing up till about 17 because I went untreated that whole time.
And like, was that happening before you were 10 in a way that you just like couldn't actually think about or understand was really happening? And it's actually you're going,
it was just my norm.
Around?
Right. That's the thing. Like, that's all I knew. I kind of knew it was weird. I kind of knew that none of my friends did that, but it was my reality. It was a part of what I just had to do.
What did your parents see?
They saw like, what they described was as an eccentric kid.
Right. Yeah.
They saw my rituals. They saw, like, I would align my socks and, like, I would, you know, align my plates and stuff. And they just thought like, wow, we have a really weird kid. Mm. Like that was totally normal.
Weird,
like,
but maybe as a parent,
quirky Katie.
Maybe as a parent, you'd think like, oh, my kid is really neat. This is amazing.
Yeah. Well, one of my intrusive one of my compulsions was about being super honest. So I was always, I never did anything bad as a kid because I just, it just caused too much anxiety. So I would always be super honest with my parents. And my mom told me, she was like, I thought I was just so lucky. Like I have this kid that doesn't want to do anything bad.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense because it's like you don't have the wherewithal to communicate the shit that's going on in your head. And so it's like, I want to say that because I don't want anyone to listen to this and go, oh, well, clearly Katie's parents were fucked.
No,
like,
they just didn't.
Because I don't think you would see that. You would just see like, well, look how cute. She's so fucking neat and tidy and like sweet.
For them, they looked at me and like, I'm turning 24 this year. Like there wasn't a lot of education around mental illness or mental health when I was younger. So my parents associated mental illness with like trauma or, you know, someone living in a bad home, someone who has gone through a lot. I had a really happy childhood. Yeah. I was really, really lucky.
And not something that like that your happy go lucky child who has like a good home environment, whatever. Not something that someone like that gets.
Yeah, exactly. So they're looking at me and they're like, you know, she's like happy and, you know, we didn't do anything. So they weren't prepared for that at all.
That's a really interesting, I've never really thought about it that way, that like a shift in like overall perception of mental health being something that happens as a result of a bad home environment or things like that, where it's something that
trauma
something has to happen.
It is really interesting to think about too, like if you haven't been exposed to that through your entire life and you grow up and you know you have kids and you don't understand what mental illness looks like as a parent, how, like, why would you have the skill set or tools to be able to handle that?
Very much so. And again, like do you have any brothers or sisters? Or?
I do. I have an older brother.
You have an older brother?
That's sort of when my parents really had to step in, because he went through a psychosis when he was 17 or 18. And so what that looked like was him coming to my parents and saying, I'm having really dark thoughts. I feel like people are after me. I feel like someone's going to shoot me. I don't feel safe. And so that's when they had to sort of step in and say, oh my God, like what's going on? And so they went to doctors, and the doctors immediately put them on antipsychotics. And so that spiraled things. And his
and your brother's not like involved in gangs or anything like that?
No, he's just, he was like your basic athlete. Like he was like popular jock kind of dude. Like he,
I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but like also just to get,
I know what you
like,
mean.
I was joking, but I was also just getting some clarity around
it. He wasn't into drugs or anything. Like
he was 17 at the time.
Yeah.
And how old were you?
I would have been 15. So I was still in high school.
Wow. Jeez.
I remember. So when he was going through that, my parents were so stressed out. They wanted to focus all their time on him. So they kind of told me, they were asking me if I would mind moving in with my aunt and uncle and my cousins in Alberta. So I knew they were asking, but I knew that there wasn't kind of an option.
Right.
You know, like they needed that time with him. He was so, so sick. So I decided to move. And during this time, I was untreated for my OCD. And I just kind of decided to hide it because it was, you know, one kid with psychosis. You don't need another kid who's like...
So at 15, you're now... I mean, sort of like bounce back and forth. But like at 15 now, you felt like you were sort of getting a grasp on like, oh, I actually... like it's beyond like, oh, I'm a little bit different from my friends, and you're starting to grasp like, oh, I might have a mental illness.
Yeah. At that point I knew, but I just knew there wasn't really anything I could do about it. Like at that point I was like, okay, the attention has to be on my brother and I just have to be okay. Like they need one kid that's not sick.
How did you come to know? Like for, you know, where was that shift in perspective where you started to say, oh, wait, like I'm sick?
Social media a little. I remember there was like this weird reality show where it was like one of those stupid Dr. Phil or Oprah or something where, you know, someone came on and they were just like, I have these feelings and like these thoughts and they make me want to do this and they make me want to do that. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, that's just like me.
Did you ever have anybody now? This is. Or maybe I won't explain it first. I'll just ask the question. Did you ever have anybody before that, like say that to you where you kind of rejected that idea and then you hear it kind of from a third party, like you're watching that, that thing where you're hearing somebody else describe it for themselves and going, oh, cause I find that, you know, I have a tendency if somebody tells me directly, like,
you have this
issue, I'm like, fuck you.
But, yeah, like when I'm like, Taylor, you're an asshole. And you're like, fuck you. And then, And then you see in a movie some guys being an asshole. And then you're like,
that's like me.
Wait, that's me. Familiar. I do that.
But in all seriousness, exactly that. Like,
I don't know if I actually rejected it or anything. It was just kind of like I saw that and it just really... felt right, but I didn't do anything about it because I didn't think there was really anything I could do. You know, it was just kind of strange. And if anything, I postponed sort of thinking about that because the phrase "I'm so OCD" was everywhere. Right, so there was a time where I thought maybe a lot of people had OCD, and I was just like not handling it well, and everyone else was getting over it, so I need to get over it too.
Right, it's like puberty. It's like we all go through puberty, and we all get over
we
our
all
OCD.
Yeah, like it's just get over it.
But
you're
did
complaining
did OCD to you or? Even if you didn't have a title for it, then did you feel like what you were living with was a negative thing, or was it like, hey, this is just
negative.
Me? Yeah.
It was really, really hard. And I think for a while when I was living in Alberta too, it got way worse to the point that I could barely eat. I was probably 90 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't sleeping a lot. I remember like going to high school, and I remember one of my friends looking at me and saying, wow, you look terrible. You look like a zombie, because my rituals would be so annoying. I would just fall asleep with all the lights on from like 10 to 2 in the morning, and then wake up and then have to do them anyway for an hour. So at that point in time, I was so wear and tear, just exhausted.
And this was the physical manifestations of it coming out, like your the weight loss and the and the lack of sleep and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Did your rituals include like restrictive eating or
that point eating was just hard to do because I always felt in pain when I ate because of how anxious I was, and I had convinced myself I probably had a health issue that I just wasn't aware of. So I didn't think anything of that. I just thought, oh, I have OCD and I just happened to like maybe have a health condition.
What's the Power Rangers thing?
Oh yeah. So as a kid, some of my intrusive thoughts beyond the whole my parents dying thing included assuming
just brush right over. Just beyond that.
Yeah, no,
that
it's
old
like
thing.
Super chill now. One of them included, so I used to watch Power Rangers like at 6 a.m. as a kid, right?
Samesies.
And the red Power Ranger turned out to be a robot, which is pretty fucking mind blowing to me. I don't know about you guys.
Wow, I don't remember that specifically, but
it was shocking
to
me.
You mean Jason, the Red Ranger?
Yeah. Was it Jason? In my head, I was like, that's Jason.
In the original Power Rangers, it was definitely
Jason. I think I'm remembering that.
That's what I thought too.
Well, when that happened, my OCD was like, you're probably a robot too. For a while, I thought I was a robot. And
Jason Lee Scott, just to clear that up, Lee Scott. Yeah, yeah.
Like, did you, like, how fully are you?
Fully. As a kid? Well, also, I think part of it was, like, I had to do all these new rituals just to handle with the anxiety that, like, you're a robot. And then it eventually evolved to, you're an alien. And then it eventually evolved to, you're not related to your parents. Which also doesn't help when you have an older sibling who's you're adopted.
Yeah.
I know that these things aren't, I know that they're not rational.
Oh, they're totally not.
But how do you choose what the ritual, like what thing becomes a part of the ritual? Like how do you get from this is a thing and to deal with this, I need to do this?
With OCD, there has never been a clear indication why I do certain things. The only thing that actually was a clear indication to me was the cleanliness, which I don't have a lot of cleanliness rituals, but the ones that I did have, I had a fear that my parents would die or that my friends would die because I was carrying a germ or I was carrying an illness that would later on pass to them. So those were like the hand washing and stuff. Those were like the only compulsions that I could say.
I'm sorry for talking about coronavirus for so long.
No,
before.
Don't worry about it. Like I don't really care about cleanliness anymore.
Okay.
No.
Wouldn't it be crazy if you realized that you had OCD and then you were like, whoa, my parents could die as a result of me having OCD, and then you un-OCD'd your OCD by having OCD about it?
What?
Do you know what I mean?
You lost me at OCD.
I followed you at the very beginning because it did actually make sense that you could reverse yourself out of it. From thinking that having it would do something, but that's
it's not
just,
really relevant to this conversation. But anyway,
it was very, very Inception, like Christopher Nolan of you.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah,
yeah.
Stop talking like a robot, dude.
This is all a simulation, anyway.
A little triggered there.
This is all a simulation.
So did you like? How did that did? Like, I guess when I hear these kinds of things, it's like, oh, I watched the Power Rangers and I thought I was a robot. And then I started to think I was an alien. And then I started to believe that I wasn't like from my parents. How do those things Do those types of things where, you know, where you're left untreated, you're not seeing a therapist mm-hmm. through this period of time.
Yeah.
Do they kind of fizzle out or not? Maybe not fizzle out, but do they like evolve out so far that yeah. like they're no longer, the robot thing is so fucking far gone now. It's yeah. it's off to, it just like is this constant evolving.
It constantly changes. As I kept going on in my life, my anxieties changed, right? Just like anyone would. When I was 17 or 16, I had my first boyfriend. And I remember someone telling me, you guys look so much alike. And then my OCD thought was, we're related. We're 100% related. And I don't know. And this is disgusting. And so I had so many intrusive thoughts about that. And I almost broke up with him because I was so stressed out by the thought that we were related.
Did you communicate that to him or what?
No, like, because I didn't want him to think I was crazy.
Oh, which, no.
Like, it's just, it's fucked. But yeah. I would go to my mom and just be like, I need you to remind me that I'm not related to my boyfriend. Like, I'm so stressed out about this.
What was your mom saying about that? Was she just like, I mean, I can call his parents.
Have you done a genetic test? Yeah.
Is it a battle between the rational and the irrational mind? Like you're going, like one part of you is going, we're related. And the other part of you is going, shut up. No, that's crazy. Then we're not.
That is therapy. When I found my psychologist, I was doing cognitive behavioral therapy, and a lot of it had to do, she always referenced a courtroom, right? And you have your rational side and your irrational side, battling it out, right? Just trying to justify, you know, and it's not like you're disregarding the irrational thought, you're just delving into it. Like, why are you having this? Could it potentially be rational?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, having your rational side.
Yeah. Like a courtroom. You're trying to pick it apart. Like you're trying to find the holes.
You're not saying that it doesn't have any potential, right? You're not just like ignoring it because that's not healthy.
Sure.
How do you find cognitive behavioral therapy? Did it work well for you?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was amazing. It got me to, I think, 70% of where I needed to be. My psychologist was amazing, and she was the first person who told me you have severe OCD. Like, you're not making this up. This is a real thing. And I want to help you, which was a huge thing.
Was this in Alberta?
No, this is in Ontario. I moved to Alberta and I eventually came back to Ontario and at that point, when I was in Alberta, I had a breaking point where I just said to my mom, I was expressing indirectly that I was suicidal and that I was thinking about killing myself. And so I just kind of said to her, if I don't get help for this, I don't want to be here anymore. There's no point. And so she took that very seriously. When she saw me too, she was very concerned about my weight. She was convinced there was something wrong there. So we went to the psychologist and I saw her for like 3 years or so on and off. And she was super, super helpful. But it turned out when I was in university that I had a breaking point and I needed to go on medication.
What did that breaking point look like?
One summer I had unprotected sex and I had a thought, I had an STI, and it just made me lose it. Like, I wanted to kill myself. I was so, so horrified, and I told my parents, and I laid in my bed for 3 days and just was thinking about the many ways I can do it. And my mom came in the room one day, and she kind of said, so you could stay here or maybe we should go to the hospital. Which option would you like? And I said, staying here. And she said, joke's on you. We're going to the hospital.
Good joke, Mom.
And then it became this family affair where my dad, my mom, my brother, we all went to the hospital together. I saw 3 psychiatrists who were sort of like the people that we were talking to about, should we admit her, should we not? 2 of them were super... I guess for lack of a better word, dicks. Like they just weren't nice. Very judgmental about my sex life and very like...
Really?
Yeah, very much like, well, you did it to yourself. And like,
whoa.
You know?
Whoa.
So
yeah.
That was very upsetting. And I was like...
Were your parents there for
no.
that?
No. Okay. Maybe. I actually don't remember. I blocked a lot of that out. Mm. I just remember feeling fury, like, or just,
yeah,
just being like, if I wasn't so zonked, like if I wasn't just so out of it, I would have fucking ripped them a new one.
Yeah.
Because I was infuriated. It was the last psychiatrist I spoke to who was phenomenal and so kind. And he treated me like a human being, which was wild. A wild concept in psychiatry.
I was following the story, and now we're talking about three psychiatrists. Is this all? How is this happening? Is this like they put you in a room and they're like, "All right, let's grab three of you guys and one at a time go in there and see what you think."
I think it was three different rooms. I don't know. It was like the weirdest night. I felt like I was
all
on
over
a drug
one
trip.
Night.
Yeah,
it
was so strange. Like I was barely even talking. But I remember the last psychiatrist was kind of like, "What are your aspirations? What do you want to do with your life? And what makes you passionate?" And then he asked about my illnesses and all that stuff. And he was the one who told my parents, "She doesn't need to be admitted. She needs to be medicated. And she has too many good things going on with her life right now to be admitted."
That's amazing.
So that ultimately led me to not be admitted, which was wonderful because the general hospital in Ottawa sucks.
So that was the right choice in your mind? Yeah.
Also, it sucks in terms of psychiatric care. I don't know about the rest of it.
Sure.
I know you had a good experience.
It's so wild how, like, when you were explaining the idea of, you know, you have unprotected sex and then you have this thought about getting an STI, and just how in most of the scenarios, like the thoughts that you've talked about coming up are the beginnings of like of things that most of us all think about, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And it's like they just don't have, it's like the mind doesn't have the checks and balances that are supposed to be there to then come to the eventual conclusion that it's like, oh, I can go about this and find out what the actual, like whether I do or not, or what, you know, like, you know, everybody's going to have everybody who has unprotected sex. It's a very rational thought to go,
yeah,
you know, maybe I have an STI and I should go get checked and blah, 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 blah. And
a healthy person is able to conceptualize for the most part, you know, oh, okay, this is what it is. And like, I could go get treated. Yeah. I could go do X, Y, Z. But
it's like the spiraling of it's like the beginnings of a rational thought that spiral out of control into these other realms. It's kind of like when, it almost reminds me of like when you're sitting around and, you know, like meditation can sometimes, I find, if you try to meditate and you're trying to think on one thing, and then all of a sudden, five minutes later, you realize you're thinking about this thing that just seems like worlds away from where you started. And you wonder, like, how did I get here mentally? Mm. Like, how did my mind get to this place?
Yeah.
It almost reminds me of like, of that in the way that, you know, your mind can go to these exceptional places that, that, you know, ultimately cause you stress and anxiety that are, you know, crippling to a large degree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's, you know, I hate to use the word interesting and fascinating, like overly, but it is.
It totally is.
Yeah.
When you have this experience and you go to the hospital and end up getting on medication, you mentioned that you said to the psychiatrist that things were going, there's a lot of great things happening in your life.
Yeah.
I imagine that going to the hospital and going through that would probably be a bit of a setback.
Yeah.
Was it challenging to kind of recover from that? Or was it helpful that there was this supportive person that kind of like gave you some of the tools and medication to get better?
It
bettered in quotation marks.
Difficult. I mean, what I didn't like was that a lot of my family members knew what happened and were kind of treating me. They weren't treating me badly, obviously. It was more like, you know, we're going to be a little more cautious, a little more sensitive because you're fragile right now. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really like that. It was kind of hard to get through that. But other than that, and I took some time off work, obviously. But after that, I was pretty good. Like, it actually was pretty quick. And I think that psychiatric hospitals and things like that, that was a norm for me because my brother was admitted in a psychiatric hospital lots and lots of times. I've been in the schizophrenia ward of the Royal Hospital, and like, I've seen all that before. So
like, by this time you had already been exposed to that. Already.
Yeah. My brother was actually admitted into the hospital a couple weeks after that.
After you were there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he does he have OCD as well?
He does, actually. Yeah, he has severe OCD. We have similar compulsions. We've had similar numbers where we both find comfort in even numbers, like 2 and 4, and we both hate the number 3.
Oh, number 3 is my favorite number.
It's like it's like the devil. Like, I don't know how to describe it.
I also love the devil. So Hail Satan. What's up with that? Has there been any? Maybe you're not the one to know the answer to this, but like, is that just by coincidence that you and your brother both, is there
no
something?
Clue.
Yeah,
my dad. Interesting. His side of the family is also known to have OCD, and he had it a bit as a kid as well. So I know his lucky or his like numbers were like 2 and 4, and he also didn't like number 3. And so
did he have an aha moment with like you and your brother where he was like, oh,
I think
shit.
He probably blocked it out. Like to him, like he's, you know, like I think for his generation, OCD wasn't really a thing to talk about.
Yeah,
it wasn't
right.
really a thing in general. So it's really, it's really strange. My brother and I bond over the OCD a lot. Like we both know, like we both understand each other to a degree.
Yeah, you understand. You can understand each other from a perspective that somebody without OCD can't quite, might not be able to get all the way. They might be able to empathize and understand. I mean, the same way that we can sit around and have a conversation and go, hey, I see where you're coming from. And like, you know, you can explain it and we can understand.
But can that lead to like, can that lead to a worse outcome? You know, like, can you guys feed off each other and be like, oh, well, you hate 3 2. So do I. It's 3. Maybe you're a 3. Are you a 3? I'm a 3. 4, 3. Like could it be something along those lines? Or
is it that fast?
Hasn't been. It hasn't been so far. I mean,
You just planted that seed.
Now I'm going to go back and see and be like, here we are. Our relationship has been kind of strenuous. We've been close and then we haven't been close. At a point right now, we're pretty good. But I think I've always been I've been at a place for a while where my OCD, I'm very okay with it. So when he isn't, I can talk him down. I can say, that's an intrusive thought. You don't really want to do that. And this is, you know, the logical side of what you're experiencing.
When you're in that space, when he's in that space or vice versa, like how hard is it to hear that? Like how hard is it to hear that and go, you're right?
I'm blanking on
Taylor, when I ask you, when I tell you you're being an asshole.
Right.
How hard is that for you to hear?
Very.
Ah.
Yeah. You know, like, it, you know, when you're in that headspace and he's saying, hey, that's an intrusive thought or vice versa, whichever way it goes. The person being told that it's an intrusive thought, I mean,
like, is the reaction like, no, it isn't. It is a real thought.
I don't think I don't think we've ever felt that way for either of us. I mean, maybe he has a little, just because sometimes you could get so into it. It's like your reality is misconstrued altogether.
Right. Yeah. Well,
right.
I know you said that he had a bout of psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever slipped into that space?
That's why I've always been cautious.
Right.
Just thinking about the different things that could lead to it. So for example, a lot of people in psychosis, smoke pot. Mm-hmm. So I try to stay clear of that only because I don't know with my genetic background. Like I just don't know.
Yeah.
So
did your brother
cautious.
By any chance? Do you know if he did?
I think the consensus is that he hasn't. Yeah.
How did we've been talking about OCD for a while now. How did the OCD lead into
anorexia?
The eating disorder.
Yeah.
So anorexia specific.
So technically the diagnosis I have is eating disorder not specified because I never gave my BMI. So they had my weight, they had my height, they had other psychological background, but I didn't give my BMI, which would have probably led to anorexia or the diagnosis.
What do you mean by you didn't give it? Like you didn't allow them to take it?
Yeah. I was very stingy about getting my body measured in any way whatsoever. Like I just like to pretend I didn't have one. And And I actually used to not weigh myself at all. I was very much into, like, the what triggered the anorexia for me was that I weighed myself one day and I was like 117 pounds and I lost my mind. Like, I spiraled, I cried, I sobbed. I was like, I'm fat. Because I had gone from being someone who was always underweight, right? Like, always like 90 to 100 pounds to being 117 pounds. And I was like, what the fuck happened here? And I had always been praised for being so light and so thin. Everyone around me, family, friends, were just like, how'd you do it? How are you so thin? And so being 117 pounds, I was like, I'm, you know, like, they're going to think I'm fat and they're going to think I'm ugly.
They
and
as in like family, general
friends,
people.
Everyone.
Yeah.
The man, the you know, man. The government. Yeah.
The government's going to think I'm fat. What am I going to do? So then on, I started restricting my diet. I started exercising a lot. I still ate every day. Like, people assume if you have anorexia, you just start fasting or you only eat ice cubes or something crazy like that. I had safe foods. I had like soups and popcorn. Those are pretty popular ones I've heard from the anorexic community.
Really? That
because of like the, because of like they have nothing. Like
yeah.
They have no caloric value.
Exactly.
At all.
I would have vegetables and fruit, coffee. Coffee's a huge one. So with due time, I eventually lost not a significant amount of weight, only because I'm kind of a petite person in general. And so my danger weight would be like probably 70 pounds or something. Whereas I got down back to like mid 90 pounds and I had people telling me, you look really thin and like, this isn't healthy. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of like, no, I'm fine. And like, this is normal. And part at the back of my mind, I knew there was something wrong. A lot of my intrusive thoughts were about being fat. A lot of my compulsions were about, you know, going for runs, pinching fat all over my body and like sucking in my stomach a lot again and again and again and again. And, yeah. No,
do you think that you, I don't know why I would, like, this is a hypothetical. So like, maybe there's no point in asking this, but I am curious, like, do you think that if you didn't have OCD that you likely wouldn't have ended up with an eating disorder?
I don't know. That's actually a really interesting thing to think about. I mean, when I started to register that the eating disorder was a problem, I thought initially that it was more like a societal thing. I thought, you know, I'm being told to be thin all the time. My friends all are worried about their weight. So therefore I am as well. So maybe this is a normal reaction. Maybe
well, partly,
this is psychological.
Right. I mean, like in part, yeah. Because when you were, when you were describing those like pressures that you were feeling, I was like, oh yeah. And like, that's kind of the part that sucks is like,
yeah.
Is the, you know, the like, oh, like, how do you do it? Like that, like mm-hmm. that is like, I, you know, hearing that I'm like, fuck, it sucks that that's a thing.
Yeah.
Mixed in with what you are exposed to already, which is the compulsive behavior and the intrusive thoughts. It's like, mm-hmm. then like combine those two things together. And then it like, it kind of breeds this new element, which becomes the eating disorder, which is, it almost seems like you're like predisposed to these other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, just hearing the whole conversation is like, you know, the intrusive thoughts, you know, lead you to think this, and then I need to do that to prevent this. And then mm-hmm. it causes the stress and it causes the anxiety. And that's like, it almost seems like you've got the OCD sort of is this umbrella and there's all these things that fall yeah. underneath it. And like OCD is actually like the sum of
the puppeteer.
Yeah. And it's like mm-hmm. all of these yeah. little aspects that play underneath it. And it almost seems like you're at risk of like acquiring like other stuff as you go along.
Yeah.
There's like all these triggers that you could never know if they're going to be triggers. It's
oh, absolutely.
Just like random things end up triggering you to like yeah. have these thoughts that lead to,
that's
you
why
know,
I'm
these rituals.
Psychosis. I'm like, I don't need another thing. Yeah. Right now it's been about a year and I've been doing amazing. I like to think for the most part. My eating disorder is still a bitch, and I currently added a new medication, actually an antipsychotic. Not for that reason. It's supposed to help with my other medication. It's supposed to amplify it so that I'm experiencing less compulsions. So that's actually been pretty helpful.
Sick Boy Podcast will be right back after this very short break.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I want to ask you more about how you're doing now, but I also am really curious about how... You're doing your master's right now. And so obviously you've been in university for a while now and you're successful enough to the point that you're doing your master's. I didn't make it through second year. So, and I didn't have any mental illnesses at the time. So, I'm curious how you've been able to, accomplish so much in spite of the fact that a lot of your life is consumed dealing with these rituals and your OCD and your eating disorder.
I ask myself that every day.
do you come up with rituals around, you know, excelling or being a perfectionist in school?
It's not even like that. They come out of nowhere. So sometimes they just sort of, it just depends on the trigger. Like I had a class where we were going to talk about STIs. And I was like, oh no.
Ooh, oh. Yeah.
So that was a really tricky one. They just come out of nowhere. I mean, I've had to leave class because of, you know, I'm too distracted. And I've had to postpone papers because, again, I'm too distracted. I've had very understanding professors, which has been, like, really helpful.
What's it like having conversations with professors about?
It's awkward and... Yeah, it's mostly just awkward.
Do you feel like you have to bring it up at the start of the semester, or is it like something that might only come up depending on situations?
I used to bring it up at the beginning, and then eventually I just waited to see how it would go. And so I've had some pretty understanding professors. Mostly I've just been able to do the work. Like I think because of the illness itself, I'm harder on myself. I'm like, I need to work harder because I have something that's holding me back in comparison to all the other students I'm working beside. And actually I've had people question if I actually have been mentally ill. Really? I've had friends who, like with good intentions, like I don't think they were trying to be mean, but it was just kind of like, are you sure you're mentally ill? Because you
should be doing worse.
You're doing your master's and like you go out to drink once in a while and you're always laughing, goofing off, whatever. Mm. Are you sure you're mentally ill? Huh. And, you know, that's mostly a performative thing. I mean, not all the time. I mean, I'm happy some of the time. Just because you have an illness doesn't mean you're always, like, gloomy and
that
like,
is
have this dark cloud over your head. Like, you're fucking human.
That's such an interesting stigma. Like, usually it's sort of the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, God, fuck. Like, you're going to be, oh, you're sad today? You know, it's like, oh, give me a break. That's wild that it's the other way around.
Yeah.
That it's like, oh, you have these mental illnesses. Like, we kind of want to see you underperforming.
Yeah. Like, we don't really believe you.
Yeah.
And yet, some people overreact too. Like, I cut myself. That's one of my compulsions. One time, I just cut my arm, and it was pretty fresh, and I wore a short sleeve t-shirt. And people freaked out. They were like, oh my God, are you okay? Should we take you to the hospital? Like, what's going on? And I was like, no, just leave me alone. Like, this is a compulsion. Like, I have it under control. Like, I know what I'm doing and I have a psychologist and everything's good. But it goes from one extreme to another extreme.
Mm. It's so funny.
But like, were you walking around bloody? You know, where people Jesus Christ, Carrie.
Like, but it's funny though, because in that situation when they're almost overreacting, it's almost like they're being irrational and you're actually being rational about it, which is it's really ironic, even though they're coming from like a compassionate place where they just want to make sure that you're okay.
Yeah. And especially with the cutting, with like, I mean, cutting from the, like, anybody who's not ever like had a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can see how that could be alarming.
Yeah. Like, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, I know it's good naturedly. I know they're not trying to, you know, be that way.
Plus also, you know, you've cut yourself and then you're feeling better doesn't mean that there might not be some underlying problem that needs to be addressed too. So even though you might be rational in the moment, it's fair for somebody to care for you and say, hey, you okay?
Yeah. And when you talk about that with your psychologist, like if a compulsion is to cut yourself, is there a conversation with your psychologist where there's like a safe way to do it?
Yeah, there always is. I mean, basically they don't encourage it, but they're not going to tell you what to do and what not to do with your body, because, you know, no one's ever going to be there 24/7 with you holding your hand. Yeah. Like, that's just a reality. So it's mostly just talking about, what are the thoughts that led you to do this? Why are you feeling this way?
What are those thoughts? Is that okay to ask you?
Yeah, absolutely. Mostly just anxiety, feeling like I'm a bad person, that I'm somehow secretly evil, and that, you know, just having all these terrible feelings about myself to the point where cutting myself for myself is about compromise. It's about, I'm not going to have these thoughts for like the next hour because I had done this thing, and that is the compromise. You know, like, I'm going to be able to just go about my life for the rest of the day because I did that. And even then, it doesn't always happen that way.
Right. Mm.
So it's kind of a lose-lose.
What do you, just to come back to your master's, because I think this is kind of interesting. You're researching something that seems to be pretty heavily relevant to your life.
Yeah. Well, that's what inspired it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why don't you tell the listeners what it is you're doing?
Yeah. So I'm doing my research on how Nova Scotia policymakers define severe mental illness and how that influences the creation and implementation of policies. So I look at it through intersectionality, which is a theoretical framework that looks at how every social factor sort of influences how you see the world, and they're always intersecting. So I'm a cisgendered, white, queer woman, young, middle class, all these things intersect with me, and they influence how I see the world and how I interact with the world. They also influence how I experience my illnesses too, right? And like how it differs for other people. Like, because I'm someone who had two parents from the federal government, I had my treatment covered. Whereas if you're someone from low income, you don't. I also can navigate the mental health system and not experience racism. That being said, you know, there is still some misogyny within the mental health system. So I've experienced that for sure. That being said, there are men who don't even access mental health services because there is that fear of how illness is expressed through femininity. Mm. So basically, I look at how intersectionality, how that interacts with severe mental illness, and whether or not Nova Scotia policymakers actually look at it through that way, and basically how the definition of severe mental illness could create inequitable mental health policies through overly medicalized discourses.
What does that mean, overly medicalized discourse?
Meaning that severe mental illness is only framed through medical knowledge, how severe mental illness doesn't, how it's not framed through our social environment, which it should be, you know, nature versus nurture, you know, there should be both. It's what I sort of try to argue, is saying that gender will influence mental illness as well as brain chemistry.
Right.
It doesn't have to be either or, whereas, you know, we have a more holistic approach to mental health now, but mental illness has always been very medical.
Is it the idea that that the people who are in place to make policy can't, because of the over medicalization of these things, they can't even really understand what it is that they're trying to make policies about.
To a degree, I think that by only using medical discourse, they don't acknowledge how there are people that are more stigmatized in the mental health system, not just because of their mental illness, but because of their race, because of their ethnicity, because of their gender. And mental illness itself is influenced by our social environment. So mm-hmm. by not acknowledging that, you're only seeing one part of the problem. So medication isn't going to solve systemic racism. It's not going to solve all these things that are going to influence your mental health and your mental illness. So they are missing a part of the puzzle, I think, that is pretty essential to addressing severe mental illness.
Is there anyone doing work to change this? Like, aside from you doing the research in your master's, like, are there people out there who are really like gung-ho to get this message out there and to make the change that needs to be made?
In Canada, yes, there is some research out there. There is a lot of talk about intersectionality with mental health and illness. Not as much as I'd like to see. Intersectionality is a pretty popular theoretical framework, but it's mostly in disability studies. It's mostly in other health issues like pregnancy, like, you know, maternal care and all these other areas. I haven't seen it a lot of mental health and illness, and particularly severe mental illness.
Is a big challenge that when you start to deal with like with large populations, you start to categorize in big chunks.
Yeah.
And the reality is, like you said, that every individual is made up of, I mean, I don't know how many influences you might put on a cap for somebody, but let's say everybody's got like 100 influences, just for the sake of the argument.
That's a lot of influences.
Right. Exactly, right?
Wow.
But then no one's influences are the same.
Yeah.
No one's 100 influences are the same. And so then you get, like you understand at a individual level that the care that somebody needs is highly individual, but the way that it's developed because of large populations,
it's blanket policies for populations that are so unique and diverse that a blanket policy cannot possibly speak to all of the populations that
need
access to.
And that's a shortcoming too. Like, I mean, it is a very, you know, it would be ignorant to say, oh, just do this.
Right.
Just apply an intersectional base to defining severe mental illness. Like, there are obviously, with population health approach too, it's like, it's very difficult to just assist everybody.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Because the person that is in that position would have to be familiar with all the aspects that could influence a person, which is in and of itself.
There's 100 of them. That's a lot.
Massive challenge.
Yeah. That's too many.
Is the problem also that policymakers the people making the actual decisions aren't diverse?
That could be it as well. One of the policy analysis I actually apply to my research is called intersectionality-based policy analysis. So it basically is a guideline. It asks questions for policymakers to incorporate equity, to incorporate power, social justice, basically looking at, you know, like addressing all the systemic oppression that would influence their creation of policies. So it tries to make them mindful regardless of your social location.
Is it possible though? Because are some biases subconscious and hard to be conscientious about, or I guess address?
I think that they would have the ability to address them still. And I mean, you're always going to have a bias. It's regardless, right? Like, if you're a mental health professional, of course you're going to rely on a medical.
I guess that's intersectionality, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's also interesting to see who the policymakers are. Like, typically they do also try to address marginalized groups. So, like, the mental health strategies I look at, they talk about how they look at different organizations that help African Nova Scotians, Indigenous groups and like all these different things. Like they do try to talk to these people, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to like hit home for them to adequately put that into the policy.
What do you want to do when you're done?
That's like, a trigger question for
whoopsie daisy.
Right now I'm applying everywhere. I mean, I would love to work for Health Canada, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I need money.
speaking of triggering, how old are you now? You're turning 24?
I'm turning 24, yeah.
How are you now?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah.
My current medication that I'm on has been very difficult to adjust to. It's really messed with my confidence.
Right.
It's a mess with my appetite as well. So I've been kind of struggling in some ways, but not too badly. Like my OCD is always going to be there. That's just a fact that I have to live with. I live with my boyfriend. And so sometimes I'll do compulsions and I don't even realize I'm doing them. Like I say things to myself and he's like, "What you doing?" stuff like that where I'm just like, oh, I didn't know. Or like I'll pinch my stomach and he's like, stop that. Like he'll hit my hand and be like, don't do that.
Is that helpful when he calls you out?
Yeah, no, it totally is. It's very helpful. And that's one of the ways that as a partner, he supports me, which is wonderful. And how friends also support me. So I still have those issues, but I'm doing much better than when I was before.
To come back to that, like, is that helpful? Is that a personal thing or is that kind of a general thing? Like maybe someone's listening to this right now and they know that their roommate has OCD, but like they haven't really ever called the roommate out on their rituals. Is that something that is typically encouraged by, you know, by like the people that you surround yourself with to, like, what would a psychiatrist or a psychologist say to someone like yourself or to a caretaker like someone in your life and say, yeah, like, let Katie know. She's pinching herself. Like, slap her hand away. Tell her.
I can't say that for everybody. That is an appropriate measure. Especially if you're just, like, if you haven't ever addressed it, I would just say, you know, let them know that you're there for them. And, like, you think that there's something wrong, but, like, that you're open to talking to them about it.
Yeah.
It's a very individual thing. Like I
totally,
it's like everyone's recovery is individual.
Which is why I told you, Taylor, not to slap that person's hand on the bus the other day.
When
you saw them pitching their stomach.
I was just trying to be helpful.
And I was like, don't do
don't
that.
Tell me what to do. Yeah. Fuck you.
Okay. Wow, man. You're being an asshole.
Fuck off.
Okay. Wow.
Katie, I guess from more of like a caregiver's perspective or somebody supporting somebody else going through OCD, how do you support your brother?
Well, I mean, I've offered to be a listening ear within reason because, you know, sometimes he's used that too much. And so sometimes I have to set boundaries and step back and say, I have my own stuff to deal with. Another way too is like just doing things with him, like going to the movies with him, where he gets very anxious around crowds. Just being there with him, right? Like helping him through those anxiety-provoking situations. That's one of the number one ways I would say to support your mentally ill friend or family member, whoever. Just, you don't need to be necessarily a listening ear. You don't need to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Just go and do normal things with them and help them get through those normal things that are really hard.
Does he live in the same town as you?
No, he lives in Ottawa.
Okay. But you guys get to see each other throughout the year.
Yeah.
Well, I, before we wrap this up, there is one question that I want to ask that we ask most of our listeners, which is, so it's a two-parter. Out of everything that you've gone through and experienced, what would you say is the biggest thing that your OCD and or eating disorder has taken away from you?
I would say my childhood to a degree, not all of it, but it made me grow up faster, which sucks, obviously. And my eating disorder has taken away a lot of wonderful experiences that were just tainted by me overthinking about my body and about, compulsions and like being too busy with those things is what I would say.
What would you say is the biggest thing that your OCD and your eating disorder has given you?
It has made me extremely empathetic. It has made me extremely mindful, and it has fueled one of my academic passions, which is pretty neat, to be an insider researcher. It also has made me grateful for all the good times, and it's made me navigate the harder times more mindfully, in that I know that they're not going to be there forever, and I know that they could be worse because I've been in worse. So it's given me a healthy perspective on how mental health can really fluctuate.
Mm-hmm. Katie, I want to say thank you so much for being so open and honest and vulnerable with us. I really connected to a lot of things you said, but I also really, I'm really fascinated in the research that you're doing. Mm-hmm. I would love to follow up and learn more about that. So,
yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I also just want to say, I love how much whenever you say vulnerable, your voice cracks, because it makes yeah. vulnerable sound so much more vulnerable.
I'm okay with that.
Don't overthink it, Brian.
Starting a ritual now.
but I do. I share the same sentiment. Thank you so much for doing this, because I think, I mean, I'm speaking for our listeners, that I think this is a really, really wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank
you. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you all so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week, as we always are, with a wonderful conversation. And in the meantime, if you want to help us out, there's a couple things you can do. You can go to Apple Podcasts and you can leave a rating and a review and hit the subscribe button.
Smash it. And then head on over to patreon.com/sickboy if you want to contribute to our Penthouse Fund. We've been drawing on that for a long time, working our way towards one of the most expensive flats in Halifax.
Yeah, we've got a long way to go.
But thank you for all of you who are inching us that much closer. But in all seriousness, your support helps us do basically everything that we do. We thank you for that. Gets us on the road, brings you more amazing conversations every week. So mm-hmm. patreon.com/sickboy. That is patreon.com/sickboy.
And if you haven't told any of your friends about Sick Boy, and you listen to Sick Boy all the time, and you're just keeping your friends in the dark about it, just don't keep them in the dark anymore.
Yeah, don't be a tailor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, just go watch the movie, pay it forward, and then you'll get the idea.
Yeah, just be vulnerable with your friends.
When you try to do it, it doesn't.
And just share what really means so much to you, this podcast. And thanks to Donovan the CPAP Morgan for the amazing sound design on this show. Thanks for making it feel like we are at the movies, comforting our friends who find it difficult to be in public places, and making it sound like I'm just digging into a big old bag of popcorn, and there's M&Ms inside of it too.
What kind of movie is it, Brian?
It's a horror movie.
Oh, this is not good. This is not bad choice.
I
for
am
the,
scared.
Yeah, bad choice for the anxiety. Trying to help your friend with anxiety.
And thanks to Take Part for the theme music on this show.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Jeremy.
Katie.
And this is Sick Boy. Sweet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.